Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
Good afternoon, I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, MeQ is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. For more information, you can go to www.mecu.com or go up to steinershow.org and click on their banner on our website, MeQ, www.mecu.com. Anthony McCarthy, of course, here every Friday, 5 to 7 p.m., and many Mondays here with me together, doing our show together, which is always wonderful.
Always enjoy it.
And we are joined today by Dr. Richard Vatz, who is a professor of communications at Towson and rhetoric at Towson University and associate editor of psychology at USA Today still.
And an author of the only authentic book of persuasion.
I forgot about that.
Published by Kendall Hunt, which has earned me a tremendous amount of wrath in my field.
It's not that it's the only book, it's the title of the book. So let's get clear about that.
Oh, man.
Come on.
I knew it was going to get tough in here. I just didn't know how quickly it would get tough.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. We're going to be joined midway through the program by Dr. Anthony Greenwald, who is professor of psychology at the University of Washington and the lead investigator on this new study on how race impacts the decisions of the United States voters. A fascinating study that came to my attention because Richard Prince has been a guest on the show before, who has a website that African-American issues and news and minority in journalism. And he had this incredibly interesting piece up there that really grabbed me. I wrote him this weekend to say thank you for inspiring this show. And so we've been reading through it. What's interesting about this study, this is a study that kind of looks at, when we get into it, it's a study that looks at the almost the unconscious behavior of human beings. It's looking at why race is still with us, the hidden attitudes.
That's right.
And not what's on the surface. We'll come back to all that in a minute at 410-319-8888. But let's just talk about the race in general for a moment. The race for president. And we did a show last week after President Obama made his announcement about gay marriage and supporting it. And it was interesting why that came about. And whether or not there would be any real political fallout from it. All these studies have shown that most African-American voters, most Latino voters in America, remain with the President of the United States of America, that didn't push them out. As one person was quoted as saying, if that's what he has to do, by any means necessary. We should support the president. But I think it might harden the line of the conservative right in America. In many ways, the conservative religious right, I should say. And I don't know how much of an effect it's really going to have on this election or not. We'll see. But my guess is not that profound.
Well, I think you're right. I don't think most people find it a bellwether issue. But there are places that do. There are places that you say the religious right, which is very much antagonistic toward gay marriage. But there are a lot of conservatives that do not find this a particularly salient issue, and that also there are many who think that the issue should be domestic policy and foreign policy and not gay marriages, and whether or not we continue paying people entitlements for the rest of our history at the level we're paying them is much more important than whether people support gay marriage or not. And by the way, just to stipulate, the president doesn't support gay marriage as a federal matter. He supports it as a states' rights matter.
And I think the president really, Mark, if you were to study, and I'm going to be as objective here as possible, I'm a supporter of this president, and I certainly am a supporter of same-sex marriage. But I view his decision last week as a very smart but very calculated move to begin to solidify the progressives in the party that you and I have talked with on this program and my program, who have been oftentimes disappointed in the president. It is the right moment as a referendum here in Maryland proceeds forward, or the possibility of a referendum here in Maryland proceeds forward, a very harsh referendum passed in North Carolina. And I think the president scored more points than I think political observers are giving him credit for. I think the gay and lesbian community have been very, very critical of this president, regardless of him being the most progressive president that we've had in generations. They were very, very critical because they did not think he was moving fast enough and he wasn't being clear enough about his support for civil marriage. And I think it is fascinating, even African-Americans that have been polled in the last 4 days, in the last 48 hours, say they are staying with the president. They disagree with him on this issue. But in many ways, I think it has not only solidified his opponents, the religious right, it has energized the progressives across the country to begin to come out in force and write checks for this president.
Let me sort of agree with you, because I think what the president – loses over 3 to 4 years is intensity. So I think – and I think what this does is it brings back some of the intensity and it brings to the polls some people who otherwise wouldn't come to the polls. The danger is for him that it also brings people who are conservative to the polls. And so – but I think any president who wants reelection has got to increase intensity. And I think that's what he does.
Can I ask you, though, Richard, not that you are the spokesperson for the conservatives or the religious right in this country, I have been amazed by some of my conservative friends. And I'm not necessarily – I'll be honest enough to say maybe they're taking this position because of the relationship with me.
Yeah.
But they have said, Anthony, we have never, ever wanted this to be a cornerstone
right.
of not only conservatism, but certainly right now with the economic and financial issues that many of them are talking about, they don't want it to be the cornerstone of this election against Barack Obama.
Well, let me tell you something. I'm a Howard – for whatever this means to people. I'm a Howard Baker conservative, okay? And I do not – let me just say, to be very clear, I do not oppose gay marriage. You know, and I imagine that most people that agree with me and have my kind of disposition with regard to conservatism,
right.
Yeah, they feel the same way.
Well, it's because there's an older path of conservatism that is either secular or doesn't kind of follow kind of fundamentalist doctrine. If people go to church or synagogue or mosque or wherever they go, that have a broader view that extends back to the days of Goldwater. And beyond, yeah. I think that there's a different.
Or Howard Baker, the former senator from Tennessee.
Exactly, right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, he kind of represents. I mean, when you find somebody whose views are almost identical to your own in each and every issue, you know, you kind of say, well, that's the kind of a conservative I am. And I read an article that opposed gay marriage, and I thought this is a good article to read through. And I read through it, and I couldn't find an argument that was really significant. And this is an area where moderate conservatives and conservatives really split because, I'm not going out making this a big issue because I don't think it deserves to be a big issue. But I just have I don't understand the antagonism. I don't understand the intensity of those who intensely oppose gay marriage.
Mark, and I was like you, I'm sure, and Richard, on Facebook, online, intense commentary from black ministers across the country condemning the president's position, including Reverend Jamal Bryant here in the city of Baltimore. Very harsh words towards the president. Very harsh words, although he kind of couched them under, I have gay friends and gay members of my church, but I will never do a gay wedding. But then went on to just vilify the president's position. Bishop Harry Jackson, one of the megachurch pastors who leads the anti-marriage equality movement in the country, took to his pulpit this weekend to, denigrate gays and lesbians. But they were both very careful not to attack the president.
Yeah, I think that the issue is going to be revolve around other things. I mean, we have the thing with Mitt Romney and being
a bully.
Yeah. It was high school?
High school. High school. Private high school.
Private high school.
47 years ago.
47 years ago.
Right.
I'm going to hear what you say, but because my take, and then we're going to go right to the phone. Here. My take on it, because it's not just about gay marriage, I just want to talk about the politics of this as well, beyond Mitt Romney's being a bully and keeping his dog in the top of his car.
Oh, Lord.
But
I think it says a lot about him.
But I want to hear what you both think.
I'm glad we disagree now. You're agreeing to my.
Maybe it makes no difference if we're just talking about an incident. So we've all done things in our teenage years
without question.
That we deeply regret.
me. Not me.
I have. I have things I've
Boy,
done
do I.
That I think I made huge mistakes as a young man.
Me too.
And would apologize to people now for what I did right. in my younger years. Right.
And I have apologized to people. I was a bully.
Well.
I was.
However, of course we all did.
His mistake was to make light of it, to laugh at it. If he had taken it seriously.
How did he laugh at it?
He chuckled and laughed in response when he was asked about it. He didn't, you know. So
that
was the problem.
That, if that was a laugh, that was a nervous laugh. I don't think he made light of it. I think his reaction is that this is one of a number of irrelevant arguments that are going to be made against me that I have to reject and with some sensitivity. And I'll tell you, the only thing that he has said that concerns me a little bit is. You know, his knee-jerk, I don't remember that. I don't believe he doesn't remember it. You know, that's the only thing that causes me some concern. But I'll tell you that to take something that somebody does at 18 when they're 65 years old now is just you're searching for a change of issue. It's people who don't want to discuss domestic issues, who don't want to discuss foreign policy.
But I have to believe, and I agree with you to a certain extent, Richard, I don't think that this is or should be a deciding factor in whether or not people believe that Mitt Romney would be an effective or good president. But I do believe that even an incident that took place in the youth of Barack Obama, I think it would give us some insight, really, more than the political I can't think of the word where there are crafted images, there are crafted personalities, there are crafted personalities that are built for politics. I think the fact that Mitt Romney says he doesn't remember, but was very clear that there were times when he went too far as a young person. I think holding someone down and cutting their hair and getting other boys involved in helping you hold someone down so that you could cut the hair, it speaks of assaulting someone. And I can remember how deeply scarring that kind of behavior can be to an individual. I'm not saying it means that Mitt Romney is a horrible, evil person, but I do believe it speaks to his character.
Well, let me tell you something that I think I've never discussed on the air. When I was 20 years old, I went to a camp that was a wonderful camp, but it had some bullies, and these bullies were 21 and 22 years of age, and every once in a while I see these guys again.
Wow.
And there were about four or five of them, and they are nice to me. One of them is particularly nice to me. They have never brought up what they did years ago, and I feel some hostility toward them. But if they were to run for an office, it wouldn't affect my vote at all. I wouldn't, you know, there is still some animus in me, but it wouldn't affect my vote at all. I wouldn't want other people to have their vote affected. You know, I want them to vote on who had the best policy. You don't vote for president on whether a person was a bully at 18 when you're 65 years old.
But I believe he should have owned up to it. That's what I would have.
In other words, not say I forget it.
That's right.
I'm with
you
on that.
He was able to just dismiss it by saying, don't really remember. I was a prankster. Everybody knows I was a prankster. But that sounds a lot like assault, not a prank.
And, well, and I think the bigger issue here is then we'll open the phones here, is the Obama campaign's two-minute ad on Bain Capital that Mitt Romney ran that bought GST Steel and then shut it down and laid off all these workers who are members of the Steelworkers Union. I mean, that to me, more than others, this is the stuff that this to
You're
me
right.
is the meat of a campaign that people should be debating, not the questions of. I mean, I think character questions are acceptable.
Whether
someone has, you know, multiple affairs, whether someone has beaten a kid up when they're 18, if they don't apologize and say, "Oh, there's a mistake."
That's relevant.
Let me articulate.
But other than that,
let me just say one sentence I have never said anywhere in my life. Did you read Susan Reimer's column this morning?
Actually, I did not. I'm sorry.
I did, and I normally do, but I didn't read it this morning.
Yeah, she was talking about an ad that the Democrats have about all these government programs in the ad that they say, could you imagine that Mitt Romney would go along with this? And the ad implies that from cradle to grave, you should have a nanny state. And she said, even given her liberal impulses, she says, not, I don't say this, she says, even given her liberal impulses, she finds the ad somewhat offensive in how much it supports a complete nanny state.
Mm.
Read the piece. I mean, it's
I'm
really,
going to read it. Yeah,
because I've never said that sentence before.
you think she's saying the ad did?
Yeah, she's saying that she's saying the Democrats have an ad that she thinks is counterproductive because it is so far left in supporting a nanny state and creating a grave governmental support of people and making people lose their incentive for individual accomplishment that she feels it hurts the Democrats and she has a negative reaction herself.
Well, I think what this ad, though, is setting up is the conversation around America. Let's open the phones here around when you tie it to what's going on now with J.P. Morgan and tying it to what oversight or non-oversight you need on capitalism, on finance, on American industry. There's the other piece in the New York Times this weekend, another journal I know you loathe sometimes, but
I love the New York Times.
Gee, and I don't. How could that be?
That in some ways capitalism itself is psychopathic. And it's behavior.
Wow.
And it has to be leashed in because it can't control
by government, right?
Absolutely by government. Yeah. Who else?
You know, there is a
by the guys who own it.
Let me tell you, there's a personal little story. There's a fellow at the University of Maryland who's in my field, and he's always supporting liberal causes and government power. And I said to him one time, Have you ever met some of the people in government who you want to give a great deal of power to? And it's the first time he and I have ever had a conversation where he stopped for a moment and he said, you know, you've got a point there. He said, you haven't changed my position, but I've got to confess, the people that I know in government who have the power are not the very people that I'd want to exercise the power.
I not so much care about the people, though, because you have to get the right people to do anything in this society, in the world. I am more concerned with you have to have boundaries, and you have to set boundaries for the financial industry, or they will take over like they're taking over now. Like you have to set boundaries on what is considered a person, you know, as opposed to United Citizens. And I think this – what I'm saying, whether you agree with it or not, these are where the issues are going to be for people in America.
I think so.
That's where the battle is going to be.
Well, I hope you're right.
I hope not, whether Mitt Romney puts his dog on the roof.
Right.
Or
– well, we share that, Mark. I mean, I'm with you 100% on that.
No, I don't think you should put a dog on a roof.
But the irrelevance when you're electing a president in important times and all times from here on in are going to be important, you know, I think that these are just irrelevant issues that a lot of people like to bring up. And the interesting thing is that – I think this is going to be a very close election. And when you have a close election, all you need are a couple thousand votes in a couple swing states to change an election.
Let's open the phones here. And I'll just leave you with this thought as we open the phones. Congress has never been this divided since Reconstruction. And our next hour, we can contemplate what that means. 410-319-8888. Let us go to some folks call in. Just hold on. I want to get some people who have not called in for a while. 410-319-8888. One of Fats' former students called in. But if you call back, Dr. Michael Carter, we'll have you on the air. So call back. 410-319-8888.
I should all become doctors.
And Renee, you're on the air.
Yes. My comment in reference to bullying, I feel I've had it done to me. And if a person does not sincerely apologize for what they have done to you from the age of 15 on, it is intentional. And it's in their character, and it will stay in their character till they're 80 or 90 years old. And that's how I feel about it, because I've had it done to me, and I have interactions with persons who have done bullying to me in my 40s and 50s, and they still have that cynical part in their personality. Thank you.
Let me give you one unrepresentative statistic and see if anybody disagrees out there. I have never known a bully who ever apologized for what he or she did. I've seen some of those who are bullies who try to be friendly with people that they bullied and imply I'm no longer like that. But I've literally never met or heard of or known of a bully who on his or her own subsequently said, by the way, you know, I feel terrible about what I did.
Does that mean that you think that then Mitt Romney was a bully and still a bully?
No, it does not. I think there is something about people that they don't want to ever confess to having done something like that. And I'd be interested if any of your callers ever was bullied and the bully said subsequently 5 years, 10 years without being asked, you know, by the way, I feel really terrible about what I did to you, and I should not have done it.
We're talking about somebody who wants to be president of the United States of America.
Well, you're talking about a strategic act, so it wouldn't mean anything anyway. So, you know, if a person strategically says, "Yeah, I'm sorry for what I did," I mean, he's not a good example, but he didn't. You're right. He didn't apologize.
Well, I was a bully in high school, and it was a direct reaction to being bullied through middle school, and I determined in my high school developed brain that I was going to be a tough when I went into high school and not let anyone bully me. And consequently, my faith strengthened as I got older, and I realized that my behavior was horribly – I was a bully. I picked on people who were, I perceived as weaker than me or who had problems, who were – and it was horrible. And I did at one of my class reunions a little over 20 years ago apologize to a young man that I made his life miserable.
Apropos of nothing, you approached the individual and said, "I'm sorry for what
almost
happened."
Definitely, as soon as I recognized who it was.
You're the exception.
I am quite exceptional.
Sure, you're exceptional, but I'm not sure. I think a lot of people have done that, mm-hmm. and I think that we need to build a society where that is part of the process.
Part of who we become.
Because we're afraid to do that in America. That's part of what has to change about where we are, I think. But 410-319-8888, Dr. Carter, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing?
Very well. Welcome.
And the reason that you think I speak so well is because that man sitting next to you, Dr. Richard Vann.
Oh, God bless you. Thank you.
He gave us a speech one day out of the blue called "Why Bitters Men the SOBs?" We had to do a 5-minute impromptu speech. I remember that from 36 years ago. He was a great teacher. How are you, Dr. Vann?
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. Thank you. I'll tell you, I enjoy teaching as much now as I ever did. It is just a joy to me. I mean, I don't mean to be trite, but it is just a joy to me.
Well, it was a joy to be in your class.
Well, thank you.
Your classes, they were outstanding. And in reference to what you guys are talking about, bullying, this is, I think, the worst thing that possibly happened to anyone, especially now. I mean, when I was in school, we had bullies, but you know, you got into a fight, you shook hands, it was over. These days, people are bullying in cyberspace, on Facebook, and all this. And I think it's far more detrimental. And something has to be done about it. It's going to get worse. More kids are unfortunately going to kill themselves, which sounds sad but true. So something needs to be done about it. And as far as the president is concerned, and you know, it's a civil rights issue. It's not about a gay issue or a human issue. You know, these people are people. They wrote and pay taxes. So if they want to get married, go for it. I got to respect them as anybody else would. But once again, I'm not going to hold up. Dr. Vann, it's a pleasure here for you, my friend. Take care of yourself, and God bless.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
Let me go back to the phones here and say that Renee called in to say, by the way, Renee called back to say that the bullies had apologized to her. 410-319-8888.
Spontaneously, yeah.
And Tarita, you're on the air.
Hi. I just called to say that I think that, at least in this Mitt Romney case, character really does matter. The stories that come up about Mitt Romney's past, over and over, events a distinct lack of empathy, for his dog, lack of empathy for that poor guy whose hair he cut. And to me, you know, since he's such a rich guy, he's never had a day where he's been poor. He's never had had a job, but still been so poor that he didn't know how he was going to afford gas to get to the job. You know, he's never had a day of worry like that. You know, I just don't trust him to be able to understand where the rest of us are coming from. And the fact that he didn't even remember this incident, I think, is just more evidence that he doesn't understand how other people feel. He cannot put himself in another person's shoes and understand what happened. The four other guys that came forward about that story, about the haircutting story, they remembered that story because they had a sense of shame about it. I know I've been on the side where, you know, in high school where someone's been bullied and I didn't stand up for them. And I remember those incidents that I, you know, maybe stood aside and laughed. Maybe I wasn't the bully, but I didn't stand up for the person.
Right.
I remember that. And he did the action, and he just doesn't even remember. That's all I wanted to say.
Let me ask a question. Let's say he's insensitive to those who are bullied, and let's say Barack Obama doesn't know anything about economics. Which bothers you more
I'm stipulating.
If that's the case, which is more important?
Well, let's say that someone's running for president and they were a bully, and their sense of economics is let's help buy factories so we can close them down and lay off thousands of workers. Who would you want? You want that person to be your president?
You bet.
Yeah.
I knew he was going to say that. But could I throw another thing in the mix, yeah. Mark, about Mitt Romney? And it's certainly a situation where I think that, Mark, as you said and as Richard said, there are real serious issues to be discussed in this campaign, and we're going to get to them. But I also am troubled by, and this was pointed out to me by a friend over the weekend, that the Mormon Church did not recognize African Americans as even having souls until the late 1970s.
Right.
And when Mitt Romney was asked about this, your church, this church you grew up in, this church that your father was so heavily involved in, a rich part of your history, discriminated against. Now, a lot of faiths did as well. And he said, yes, it troubled me and my family for a very long time. Well, I'm not sure how you remain part of a faith that doesn't consider an entire group of people to have souls or even worthy of this so-called redemption. And his answer was so dismissive because I understand not wanting to get distracted and pulled into a conversation about your religion. But I'm not sure if he ever goes far enough for me in calling something wrong, unless, like he did at Liberty University over the weekend, defined marriage so clearly as between a man and a woman. He threw so much red meat to that graduating class at Liberty University. But I want him to be able to say with equal passion that he believed that discrimination and racism that existed in his church and probably still exists in the Mormon church is wrong.
Okay, Anthony, let me ask you this question. Let me categorize your statement as saying to Mitt Romney, "Where were you, man?" Now, what do we say to Barack Obama, who for 20 years?
No, I have to disagree with you. He's not saying, "Where were you?"
Yeah,
he's saying, "Where are you now?" About what happened in the past.
In your church.
Now,
okay, yeah.
Where were you then?
Okay, all right.
That's a big difference.
All right, but let me concede that's a weakness. None of these things is perfect. How about Barack Obama when he suborned Jeremiah Wright's outrageous remark for 20 years? You know, what does he think about that? Where is he? He all of a sudden says, well, yeah, I think we're probably going to part company. I'm telling you, you cannot find perfection.
I don't think they're the same thing.
Oh, why not?
Well, because, first of all, I think a lot of what Jeremiah Wright was saying in terms of analysis about especially where black folks look at it, where analysis about America and where racism comes from and what's happened to black people in America has a lot of validity in the history of this country. A lot of what Jeremiah said, I've read a lot of his sermons, are dead on.
What
was it that he said you didn't like?
Oh, my God.
Before we go to break.
Goddamn America.
What?
Goddamn America.
I think there are a lot of people who have come from in ways of oppression here that might feel that way in their gut and say it sometimes. It doesn't mean that's –
But there is – look.
And that's also taking a piece out
because
of what
he said.
Because the entire sermon is taken out of context.
Oh, my goodness.
It is taken out of context.
So in other words, if somebody gives a speech and at the end saying, by the way, let's kill all the Jews, but the rest of the speech was fine.
That's not the same thing.
Wow,
it's not the same thing, but it makes the point about taking a segment of a speech and saying, yeah, but the rest of it was fine.
No, it's not the same. That's really an absurdist rhetorical argument.
No, it is not.
We'll be right back. That's absurd, man. That's absurd. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Here with Dr. Richard Vatt. On the way here, I want to say congratulations to Cynthia Holdham of Nottingham, Maryland.
All right.
She is our grand prize winner for a trip for two to the Curaçao North Sea Jazz Festival, August 31st to September 1st, 2012. Courtesy of the Curaçao Tourist Board, Princess Beach Resort and Casino, and Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Cynthia Holdham, thank you for your support of your public radio station, WEAA. Enjoy yourself in Curaçao.
Do your listeners know you hit me during the break? I'm just saying.
He's joking.
Don't say that. We don't have much time to explain he's joking. Because if I hit him, he wouldn't be talking. He'd still be on the floor. Anyway, stop. We have to get serious. One of the things that inspired the show today was the piece written by Richard Prince on his website that talked about this study about race and the campaign and voting, which I found fascinating. I've been for years interested in how you get to a place where you talk about race and can look at what people feel about race and go beneath and find the hidden attitudes, the subconscious, how that adds to our everyday living. And how we perceive things in the practicality of our everyday life, and that was the study we talked about. One of the lead people on this study was a professor of psychology at the University of Washington on the study on how race impacts the decisions of United States voters. Dr. Anthony Greenwald joins us by phone, and welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark, and please call me Tony.
Good, Tony. Thank you so much. So, Tony, tell us about this. Tell us about this study, how you did it, and what it said. For the listeners who haven't seen it, we'll have all the on our website. You'll have attached to a study and to the articles. But talk a bit about what you found and how you did it.
Well, we first did a study in 2008 in the Obama-McCain election, and we found that race bias measured several different ways, including the implicit association test, which is our method of getting at subconscious or implicit biases. We call it an automatic white preference. It's very different from racism. We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
We found that this predicted favorability for McCain, that is, people with more bias were more in favor of McCain. Because that study produced such interesting results, we repeated our methods, starting them in much earlier this time, in January, looking at the Republican primary contest and how the voters were evaluating the Republican primary candidates against Obama and against each other.
And I'm interested in kind of what it means and how you go about understanding hidden attitudes. I mean, that thing to me is critical, how you went about it, how you, in a survey like that, would unearth that with the people that you interviewed and how you interviewed them.
It's not done by interviews. It's done by a task, actually, that involves responding to faces of black and white people and words meaning pleasant and unpleasant things. I'd take up 2 or 3 minutes if I tried to describe it.
It's all right. Take up 2 or 3 minutes. Describe it.
I took a test. I knew the test.
Oh, well, okay. Just very quickly, if you are faster in giving the same response to pleasant words and white faces, this indicates what we call an automatic white preference, and this is in comparison with giving the same response to pleasant words and black faces. I mean, that's really the short summary, but the best way to understand it in more depth is actually to go to the website and try it. I don't know if you have a link to it, but it's implicit.harvard.edu.
Say that one more time for listeners. I'm sorry, say it one more time.
implicit.harvard.edu. Harvard University very generously provides us with the server that we run this out of.
Anthony McCarthy, I have a question.
Tony, I'm very curious, Professor Greenwald, I'm very curious about how this preference actually breaks down with the African-American or the black participants. Is there any indication, and I kind of know the answer because I read some of this, but I think it's fascinating about white preference?
Yes. So we find this. Okay, so I didn't answer part of the question before, which was what we learn from this.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
What we learn from this is that this automatic white preference, very different from racism, as I was saying, and is something that is shared by about 75% of white Americans, Asian Americans, somewhat less Hispanic Americans, and African Americans don't. You might expect they had the reverse. They might have an automatic black preference, but in fact they don't. On average, they are pretty much in the middle, with some showing white preference, some black preference, and some neither. So this is something that people are not aware of having, and many of the people who have this, at least half of the people who have this, will describe themselves as egalitarian, and we do ask questions about that on the study. And they say, I like black and white equally, and we believe them. We don't believe these are, maybe some people are misrepresenting, but we think the great majority of people are telling us honestly that they do not feel any racist attitude. So this is something that's, it's in my head. I was surprised to discover it when I first took this test in the 1990s, and it's there in a lot of other people, and it's not just a curiosity, because it's something that can affect behavior also.
Now, I know you don't have very long with us, Tony. You have to leave soon. I will let our callers join the conversation after at 410-319-8888. One of our guests this evening to talk about national politics here is Dr. Richard Vetz. He's professor of rhetoric at Towson University. And his perspective may be a tad different than ours, but I'm sure you have a comment or a question.
Professor Greenwald, I'm a bit of a skeptic, so let me ask you a question or two. How do you validate these findings?
Well, the procedure has been used in actually over 1,000 research studies now, not all on race. I mean, a good proportion of them, maybe 5 to 10% are on race, but procedure has a lot of validation, and I was holding out my opinion on this as to whether it was something that had significant societal impact until after about 10 years of doing research with it, and this is not my research, but lots of other people's research, we could put the results together and find that it actually predicted discriminatory behavior. I wasn't sure that was going to happen, but it did very clearly emerge.
But if white people favored McCain in the 2008 race, and if white people were shown to be prejudiced, don't you have really a post-hoc ergo propter hoc argument here that what you're doing is you're merely showing a correlation, you're not showing any cause, that there's really no way to show that it is because of race that people voted for McCain, for example?
I mean, you're right that these are correlational data, and the question of what's the primary causal factor here is difficult to unearth, so I'm open to multiple interpretations on that. But we do know that it's something that is correlated with voting preference, and it seems to be correlated with voting preference in a way that's not carried by other variables. So the question is, what does explain it?
And Richard, I would argue that, as Professor Greenwald mentioned in the beginning, not prejudice, but preference. I see those as two very distinct things.
But you don't. Let me ask you this. One last question. Right. You don't find an African American preference for African Americans. Did I understand you to say that?
We find it actually mixed for African.
And yet, African Americans vote 93% for President Obama. How do you account for that?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear. I know African Americans were overwhelmingly for Obama, even more so than for previous Democratic candidates. I think there's a race thing involved in African Americans, but of course they're only 12-13% of the population, so their biases don't count nearly as much as do those of white voters.
So let me get to a couple of callers. I know you don't have very much time with this. You have a couple more minutes. Tony, you have to run now.
Okay, I'll hang on a little.
Just let me get some people in here. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Clarence. You're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Steiner, and to your guests.
Hi, Clarence.
How you doing?
Hey, I'd just like to ask one of your guests, how much would you say the results of your study is based on the fact that race is such a widely used political weapon between the political parties? Do you see any, or have you been able to discern whether or not that is a major factor, or, you know, thank you.
Well, if race is a weapon, it's largely a hidden weapon, because it's something neither Republicans or Democrats want to talk about and try to persuade people to use race. But I do believe that it's a factor that does need to be taken into account. For example, I believe that Obama won in 2008 despite the racial basis for opposition, and one can attribute that to the fact that George Bush sort of ruined things for the Republican Party in 2008.
Let's get one more comment here before Tony Greenwald has to run at 410-319-8888, and we'll continue the conversation after he goes. Gary in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, as you guys began to bring this to the fore, I couldn't help but think back to the psychological experiments that were done on the black children regarding Brown versus Board of Education. Mm. And, you know, you had the legal teams, including Thurgood Marshall, scientifically showing how these black children preferred whites over themselves. You know, they preferred white dolls, the white dolls over the black dolls. And what I also wanted to bring in to this discussion here is the fact that black people are the moral barometer here in America. You know, we have that right to be the moral barometer. And what you do is you look at the situation as it pertains to what's being said right now. You know, the guy started talking about, well, Obama and stuff like that. Where I go to is just the facts. Just go to the facts. And what you'll find in every single case, and I have, by the way, in the back of my truck right now, I have The Shame of the Nation by Jonathan Colzel. You know, and I know I'm going off on a tangent a little bit, but again, I must repeat this. Black people are the moral barometer of America. And we have the right to do that. And yet, even though we have the right to denigrate, nonetheless, we still love everybody. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Gary, thanks so much. I don't know, Tony, if you can comment to that or not, but you're welcome to try.
Well, I'll just say something quickly, and then I'll disappear.
Please don't.
The listener is absolutely right to draw the connection to that study that was done in the late 1930s by Kenneth and Mamie Clark that was used in the Brown and Board Brown versus Board of Education decision. There's a real continuity between the techniques we're using nowadays to study subtle race bias, and that was an early example of it. Now, on moral barometers, you know, maybe black people do have more of a right there. They are actually freer of racial biases than white people, I'm sure. I do know, however, that I have no right to be a moral barometer.
Tony Greenwald.
Me either.
I appreciate your being part of the show today, professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Thanks, Mark.
And we'll be talking to you again soon, I hope, and we'll be posting all the information on our website so people can look at this and wrestle with this. I appreciate you taking the time for us today.
You're welcome.
Good to talk to you, bud.
Bye.
All right.
You know what, Mark? Interesting, and I know we have other callers that need to join in the conversation. I am the kind of person, I will admit, that I would have tried to skew that study. I would have been very conscious of what my response is because I would want there to be a black preference. And I know that's kind of counterintuitive what people think I may think. I am a very fair-minded person. I have my own biases just like everybody else. But I would have wanted the percentage of black preference to be higher. And as I read that study, it was deep to me how many African Americans, through those the selection of those words, the reaction to those words, and the pleasantries on those faces that they chose, have a white preference almost built into our character.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, to me, it's the inference goes to the study that took place years ago and was recently redone with young children, black children being shown dolls. Which one do you pick? Do you pick the ball that looks like you, the black doll?
Or which one do you think is pretty? Which one do you think is good? Which one do you think is, you know, it's really telling. Simple, but very telling.
Let me just say, without getting into it, I think that those studies are valid. I do not think this study is valid.
Really?
Yeah. I don't find
it. Did you read over some of the
points? Oh, I went through the study. I read the study. I read the reaction to the study. And I think it's showing faces which are labeled white or black and words as good or evil. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can infer what he infers from that. And that's why I was asking about the validity of the study. I mean, again, you conflate that with those earlier studies where blacks and whites are preferring one color doll over another color doll. I find that telling. I don't find this study telling.
But what he did then is he meshed that with people's voting preferences.
Yeah.
And how they voted. And yeah. I think that when you have that, I mean, what we don't want to talk about often, I think, is that when you have in America only 43% of white Americans voting for Barack Obama, that the party that represents more an interracial America just by the way it looks, Democrats always get fewer white votes, no matter who the candidate is.
So the
complexity of what he talked about as well, and of what we're going to talk about the next hour, I think that race does play a part of it. And I think the problem where we're getting to maybe with studies like this, and I want you to jump in here, but where we're getting with studies like this is to be able to talk about those kind of racial issues and race without name calling people as racist,
right.
but talk about the power that race has in defining what happens in our country.
I do think race is relevant. I don't think this study shows us that race is relevant, but I do think in a national election, you cannot argue that race is irrelevant. It isn't irrelevant; it's relevant. But I don't think it's dispositive. It's obviously not dispositive because Barack Obama won the election
with a minority of white voters.
Yeah, but
and
that
even now that Mitt Romney knows that he has to win, if Barack Obama wins more than 38% of the white votes, he could lose. That's part of
that's the dynamic. That's part of that dynamic.
But you also have to at some point address the fact that he gets over 90% of the African American vote.
Sure, he does. Because people who've been it's just like he gets over 78% of the Jewish vote.
Yeah.
Right.
You're right.
So I think that people who have come out of a certain kind of oppression are going to vote in
So how long should he get a presumption because of the color of his
presumption.
Skin?
It's not a presumption. It's a reality of the nature of oppression and what it does to people's consciousness.
Oh, but you're awfully forgiving of one side and not the other. I mean, it does not
What's
make sense.
What's the other side I'm not forgiving of?
The side you're not forgiving of.
The one that did the enslavement?
I'm saying
the oppressors?
For people to vote on race, mm-hmm. I think is not justifiable.
I think it is. It can be unjustifiable. If you vote on the matter of race because I'm the race that's dominant and I want to keep it that way, or
that's
you vote
appalling.
On the race,
I think that's appalling.
Really? Why?
What I said is appalling.
No. I think it's appalling to vote against somebody because they are a race different from you. But I think,
on both sides, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So let me open the phone screen. Right?
Yeah.
410-319-8888. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi,
hey,
Andrea. How are you?
Good. How's everybody?
Good.
Have a party.
Well, I may or may not be popular for this, but I don't know. But I'm going to be honest. When I voted for Obama, race had a lot to do with it. Yeah, now that wasn't the only thing, but yeah, it had a lot to do with it. So, I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, that's a reality. I mean, and it's a reality even beyond elections. I mean, when you have teachers in class with a predominantly black classroom with a white teacher, sometimes big connections are missed and it raises challenges in teaching. And so, I mean, race is an issue. When I go to a doctor, the first person I look for is a black doctor. But at the end of the day, if I don't feel like in my gut they're treating me right, then I'm going to find a qualified doctor. So, yeah, I think race is a factor, but I think, you know, a good part of the voting population will also look at qualifications. And me personally, I'm going to vote for Obama again. There's some things he's done that I don't like. I wish he was a little bit more vocal about education. But I have to pick the lesser of two evils. And to be honest, I don't like most of the people in politics in general. I don't care what color they are.
I'm with you. Except I can find some exceptions.
Can I say something about the last study about the dolls? And you guys are just going to so kill me for this.
Well, I would never do that, Andrew. Go ahead.
But, you know, when they do this study on these young kids now, it's not going to matter what color the doll is. It's going to matter how much clothes she has on. So she looks like she's a stripper doll, then
they're
like, oh, yeah, that's the one we like.
Things have changed.
Actually, you know, what you just said, I think that I'm not sure if I agree with the former thing you said, that it would change. I don't think it would change, but I do think that the hypersexualization of our culture does kind of damage our children's and our adults' perspective on this world. I think that's absolutely true. I think that is a huge problem.
We agree on
that. That's what I was trying to put out there, that, it's ridiculous. Like, now it wouldn't even be an issue of race. How much the values have shifted to that. Then it doesn't matter what color the doll is. It matters how less of clothing she has on.
I think that could be a factor. Andrea, hold on. We're going to get your telephone before you go, because we're thinking about putting together a panel over the next few months of different guests who call in a lot to have you join us on the air live. So hold on. You mind doing that? So let's try to get one more call in here very quick. Terrence, a final quick thought.
Great. Listen, gentlemen, this idea of white preference needs to be understood in context. Ideas don't drop out of the sky.
Right.
We live in a Eurocentric culture. Mm-hmm. Every magazine, movie, and television show tells us that the blonde is beautiful. The blonde with blue eyes is beautiful. Now, when Richard Burton, who translated the Arabian Nights, traveled in Africa, a white man, he reported that the natives there were horrified at his appearance. There is an incident in Egyptian history where the Egyptians ran from European-looking people because they thought they were lepers. In the ancient world, pale skin and lank hair was thought to be a disease. That is, in Africa. But we live in a society, and just recently, a television news program reported that some people in Europe had scientifically determined that a blonde, blue-eyed woman was most beautiful. These are concepts that are propagated constantly. Black people are bombarded with them.
Attention, we're almost out of time. So
brainwashed by them. That's why you get these responses.
Thank you, Terrence. Now, I think that we have built a culture.
Oh, without question.
Around the white beauty and white dominance. That does filter, change things. I think that's something that I do believe that the new America we're building.
I do too, Mark. The standard is changing.
In the generations to come, it's going to change.
Yeah.
I think it's
and
changing
it
now.
Yeah.
It's beginning to change. It will change even more. Yeah. And we're going to take a break here. We have to take a break. And I'm sorry, those of you who called in, it didn't get in. I just did that because a lot of people we've not heard from ever or in a long time, we took those callers first, so apologize. That's no personal slight intended.
They can still buy my book. I'm just saying.
And what was the name of that book be again?
The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion, published by Kendall Hunt. I'm just saying.
Well, you just said it.
He just said it several times.
Did he? Rick Vatch, thank you so much for being
Thanks.
Here.
Thanks. Good to be with you, fellas. Thank you very much.
Anthony McCarthy and I will be right back. When we come back, we have a discussion on the book and documentary called, book and documentary called Slavery by Another Name, the re-enslavement of black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, an amazing piece of our history. Stay with us. We'll be right back.